Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. The Thomas Cole National Historic Site in Catskill, New York, has opened a new exhibition titled Native Prospects, Indigeneity and Landscape. It juxtaposes an indigenous approach to the articulation of their homelands and the environment with the American landscape paintings of Thomas Cole, which are rooted, of course, in European tradition. The exhibition presents 19th century paintings by Thomas Cole featuring native figures in context with indigenous works of historic and cultural value and artworks by contemporary indigenous artists. Bringing the 19th century into conversation with our present moment, this cross-cultural exhibition offers profound interpretations of American art and land. Scott Manning Stevens, Dr. Scott Manning Stevens, is the curator of the exhibition. He's Associate Professor of Native American Studies and English at Syracuse University, where he is also Director of the Native American and Indigenous Studies Program and Founding Director of the Center for Global Indigenous Cultures and Environmental Justice. Scott, thank you very much for being here.
No, thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Kate Mencaneri, Chief Curator and Director of Curatorial Affairs and Contemporary Art and Fellowship at the Thomas Cole National Historic Site in Catskill. Kate, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. I'm so grateful to be here.
I want to learn a great deal about this exhibition from Scott, but first put it in context at the historic site, please. Tell us how it came to be there now.
Well, I mean, we've been thinking a lot about expanded narratives of the past and working for a long time to think more deeply about the history of our place, the history of landscape. These are things that Thomas Cole, as an artist, was thinking very deeply about, the natural world, art and history. And so today at the Cole site, we activate this legacy by thinking more deeply about that. And we know at the Thomas Cole site that, Cole didn't invent landscape painting, but in fact, there's so much to unpack, but I think we wanted to bring together an expanded narrative about the past and a blue sky vision for the future to recenter Indigenous perspectives at our site, that where land and landscape is so important, but also art and history.
Scott, could you tell us about putting the exhibition together and what areas of interest it shines a light on for you?
Sure. I was delighted to have the opportunity to think more deeply about this and realize it in the form of an exhibition, because I've long discussed, both in my own work and in my teaching, some of the inherent problems of the landscape tradition that we get from the European tradition. So one of them is that it pays little attention to indigenous populations and presence, if it doesn't evacuate us all together. So as a member of the Akwesasne Mohawk Nation and person who considers this my homeland, not necessarily the Hudson River Valley, but this part of the world, Northeast, we play so little part in that landscape tradition. And when we are used, it's more of a kind of decorative representation. A single, solitary native figure, usually very tiny, put there for scale and a reference to maybe geography. You know where you are because there's a native person there. And usually, I would say in Cole's perspective, a symbol of the past, because it's an idealized nature as he thinks it looked before it was settled. And that always bothered me because, of course, it wasn't a wilderness. It wasn't devoid of human life. It was a place that sustained thousands of humans and our communities and our villages and forests were managed. And there were trails and there were, interventions in streams and there was cutting and burning for safety reasons and so on. And none of that is ever apparent in that American landscape tradition. In fact, we're usually posed in a kind of relationship to the sunset. And the sun is setting on Native America in 1830s and 40s. And this isn't just a coincidence. It's very much part of the news in their world. In 1830, we see the passage of the Indian Removal Act by Congress, and it specified in that act that all indigenous people east of the Mississippi must be removed west of the Mississippi. And that will be from Maine to Florida. It's most famously known for the removal of the Cherokee and the other so-called civilized tribes, five civilized tribes, with the Trail of Tears. But there's also a Potawatomi, Trail of Death in the Great Lakes region,
right,
and countless other people.
Often think about it being down there in
right.
Oklahoma, but it was everywhere on
right.
the East Coast.
The goal is to settle them in Oklahoma, which was Indian territory.
Right.
But Midwestern and Great Lakes nations get put in what is now Kansas and suffer the indignity of being twice removed, because as soon as settlers get near Kansas, they think this land is way too good for Native people to be on. And they remove them a second time to what is now Oklahoma. But anyway, the landscape tradition, I just wanted to step back and think about how do indigenous peoples represent the land? Because we don't have a tradition of representational painting that comes to Europeans, but we certainly represented the land, and in abstract ways that emphasized our relationship to the land. So I wanted to start with those ancestral pieces and then jump forward and look at contemporary Native pieces.
So the exhibition features, as I mentioned in the introduction, 19th century paintings by Thomas Cole in context, as you've just mentioned, with indigenous works of historic and cultural value. Could you describe some of the works? What are we seeing from?
Right. So of the works we have, what we would put under historic and cultural value, they are facsimile works because the originals are unavailable,
oh,
though
sure.
extant. One is a famous work called Powhatan's Mantle, which is currently at the Ashmolean Museum at Oxford University, where it has been since 1683. And this is several deer hides sewn together and then embroidered with or beaded with shells, and forming patterns that represent, we believe, the authority and sovereignty of the Powhatan Confederacy in the Chesapeake Bay area near Jamestown. So it is, its history is that it is a gift to the colonists at Jamestown, a gift that basically reasserts their sovereignty over that land. And the spiral circles on it, there's over two dozen of them, basically represent communities or towns that are part of this confederacy. So it is, in effect, a map, not a mantle,
mm-hmm.
most likely.
Okay.
Another piece is the Gaswenta, or representation of the two real wampum. This is a famous treaty belt between the Haudenosaunee, or Iroquois Confederacy, with the Dutch. So primarily between my people, the Mohawks, and the Dutch, and the northern end of the Hudson River, where Albany is today. And so when the Dutch wanted to put a trading post there around 1614, there had to be some agreement as to how they could be there and what they would be doing. And the two-row wampum is a very elegant and simple thing to imagine. It is a white belt of wampum shells with two parallel purple lines. And the belt represents the Hudson River, and more broadly, natural resources. And the two parallel lines represent, respectively, the wake of a Native canoe and the wake of a European vessel. And they're perfectly fine to travel parallel lines to, next to each other, as long as they don't cross. You don't try to get in my canoe. I don't try to get in your boat. And it's a representation of mutual, you know, recognition of autonomy. And we never say it means they can't contact each other. Traditionally, we say they're only a handshake away, but they must run parallel to each other and not intervene. So that's another one of these traditional ones. And then finally, the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee Sky Dome motif, which you can find beaded on clothing. You could find it on basket work and other representations. But it is in miniature and very abstract miniature, a cosmology of the Haudenosaunee world. And we have a contemporary artist rendering that for us as well. So there are three pieces that are predating the landscape tradition that we know as the Hudson River School by hundreds of years.
And we mentioned the exhibition then goes into work by contemporary indigenous artists. What are some of those works and how were those artists and pieces selected?
Sure. So I wanted to look a little more broadly than the region or the Northeast. And so I have some works by contemporary Native artists from the region, like Alan Michelson, who's Mohawk as well. And he's a multimedia artist who does work in film and in sculpture and so on, and installations. And a lot of his work has looked at the degradation of the land in contemporary times, environmentally and politically. And so we have a piece of his video piece of it's a trip up the Hudson at night, filming the shoreline and its real fluctuations from sometimes looking like it might have been in older times. No visible buildings or anything, but other times industrial sites and then sometimes luxury homes. And
yes, the many extreme luxury homes, huge bridges.
The many sites that dot the river, and that's called Shatamuk, which is an indigenous word for a portion of the river. And then there's another piece by contemporary artist of great renown, Kay Walking Stick, who's Cherokee. And she's done a series of diptychs, two paintings side by side of traditional landscapes, ones that we might recognize as landscape painting, but she has superimposed on them these abstract designs of the people of that region. So say she's doing something in the Southwest, she might take an abstract representation of mountains, which people might generally just see as a geometric pattern, mm-hmm. but it represents a landscape. And she's superimposed that over to kind of reclaim that empty landscape for the people for whom it's home. And we have a beautiful painting of hers that's directly responding to Thomas Cole, his famous Oxbow painting, where she's put a Potemkin design over it and posed the question, where are they now? And where are they in your vision? Where are they now politically, ethnically, and so on? And another artist we have is young Mandan Hadassah, artist from North Dakota near Fort Berthold, the traditional lands, and named Teresa Baker. And she works in mixed media again, though primarily wall pieces. She has done some sculptural pieces with basketry, but she's mostly doing things that you would hang on a wall. But really has kind of rejected the rectilinear frame for landscape and allowed the shapes to be much more free-formed. And I often think of them, not all of them, but a lot of them are reminiscent to me of when you fly over in a plane over that country that we call flyover country a lot, and look down on it. There's this really fascinating patchwork of natural prairie and then highly agricultural, industrial agricultural lands, highways, all sorts of things, ranching. And you do get this wonderful quilt work. And her pieces are often like just one patch of that where you figure, oh, that reminds me of a road. They're not representational in that way. And they use unexpected materials like astroturf, on which she likes to paint, or cool imitation buffalo hide and things like that, where she'll weave in and references to her own culture, Mandan Hadassah culture, because they were, though they were up in the upper plains, they were not a horse nation, as we called the others. They were largely sedentary agricultural people. And so she'll weave in corn stalk pieces and willow and things like this that represent the specificity of that place to her people, and not, you know, some generic open plain, because they had very specific places they dwelt along rivers, and their culture grew up. So, and then finally, Brandon Lazur is a contemporary Haudenosaunee artist who renders and plays with ancestral designs, I think. There is one piece by a non-living contemporary artist, and that's Truman Lowe, who we lost not so long ago, who's a Ho-Chunk sculptor. And it is a real stunning piece that represents, kind of in 3D, a waterfall. And it's made of long, very thin pine strips coming projected off the wall, and they just naturally fall by their own weight, like water tumbling down a waterfall. And we have that. It's paired next to Thomas Cole's Catterskill Fall, one of the Catterskill Falls paintings. And the Truman Lowe piece is, again, just a beautiful piece no matter what. But I also like that for him, when he talks about the waterfall pieces he did, they evoke childhood memory and spending time with his parents collecting wood to be pounded into splints for his mother's traditional basket making. And that's why he likes those long, thin wood. That it's not just a nice representation of water, but it has a tie-in with a very traditional Ho-Chunk kind of craft and art. So
I hope this question isn't too far in the weeds, no pun intended, or actually, I guess pun intended, but in using all of these organic elements in their artistic creations, do the pieces degrade? Are they not intended to last, or are they preserved in a way that will make them last? And even as they last, might they change when addressed by elements or time or light, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in the case of Kay Walking Sticks, just painting in, you know, oils or acrylics, and so right. No different than any other contemporary painter. And then Truman Lowe's work, though it is organic, I mean, I think wood sculpture is fairly stable given its position in an environmentally controlled place. I mean, if it were outside, sure.
Yeah.
But I think in a museum setting or anywhere else indoors, it's quite stable. Alan's work, the digital work, I guess there is such a thing as degradation.
Oh, yeah. No, I digital. Didn't mean that one. No, that'll last for a while.
Yeah. And I think, well, I also think in Teresa Baker's work, which does draw on a lot of synthetic materials, they'll be fine. But yeah, you may have pieces of the corn husks
right.
break off, or a twig or something. They could be repaired. And I don't think an artist would be against it. It's not like, although that changes everything. But I think that's part of their fragility, and that there's a certain fragility to the environment that is represented there that is quite different from the artificial environment of AstroTurf or something like that. And I think that that's a deliberate gesture, that she's well aware of the stability or instability of materials as she combines them. And I like that part of it.
Certainly. Kate, in the last minute we have here, are there any events surrounding the exhibition you would like to tell us about?
We have a number of fun things, but I really just want to encourage everybody to come and see the exhibition in person, because the work is so dynamic. It's incredible to see all of these gorgeous Thomas Cole paintings and then move beyond the single point perspective of landscape and to see these dynamic, gorgeous artworks that really fill the space and take us to an experience of land and landscape that I think is really profound. And it's been an honor to work with Scott on this project. So there will be, do stay tuned and come to visit.
Do visit.
Yeah, come and see the work in person.
Native Prospects, Indigeneity, and Landscape is on view at the Thomas Cole National Historic Site in Catskill, New York, through October 27th of this year. It's thomascole.org for more information. When I am off the air later, I will post this interview to the website, and that link will be included, of course. Our guests have been Dr. Scott Manning-Stevens and Kate Mencaneri. Thank you both very much for sharing with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, it's thomascole.org. The Roundtable returns after this.